Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Raspus. Okay, as I promised last week, we are going to look in-depth at the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. We're going to dissect, take apart some of the main elements of that agreement. But before we do so, it's important to understand how we got here. What is the role of free trade agreements like the TPP and others that are soon to follow, TTIP for Europe, TISA, Services Agreement for Europe, being negotiated? There's over 50 different trade deals, some of them multi-country, that the U.S. is involved negotiating right now under Obama. We've never negotiated and pushed so hard on so many massive trade deals, free trade, free, so-called, ever before in U.S. history. Obama is the biggest free trader in the last half century in this country. Let's make that clear from the very beginning. But, you know, it's not just Obama. This is a consistent trend since the 1980s, maybe even before. The U.S. has been a proponent of free trade, and we need to understand why and how that is. What we see now is just the culmination of decades of pushing a number one priority by U.S. big businesses called free trade. It's important to understand the origins of this and therefore the purposes and functions of this. Free trade agreements are not simply about exchanging goods and services. That's what they tell you in the media. Free trade is about moving money around. It's about money flows as much as good flows. And whether it's good flows or money flows, it's all about increasing the wealth and profits of large corporations. And I emphasize the adjective there, large corporations. Small, medium businesses, especially those who do not export, do not get any benefits from this. In fact, they're probably going to get smacked by imports from these other countries. Workers, of course, do not get any benefits from this. You know, they talk a lot about, oh, this is the best free trade agreement, TPP for American workers. We have all these labor protections. That's BS. We see very clearly over the last several decades that trade, and especially free trade, according to treaties, results in a lowering of the wage for middle, median income workers. Now, maybe the very top 5-10% of the labor force benefit some from this if they're in the right industries. But the rest, it means wage stagnation, wage decline. There's something called the import-export wage differential. And very clearly, it shows that from free trade agreements, U.S. workers who are negatively impacted by imports to the U.S., their wages decline faster than U.S. companies who benefit from exports, wages rise. There's about a 20% wage differential. So as we have more free trade, more imports, even though we get more exports, the net effect is wages going down. Okay. So it's important to understand who benefits from this. It's important to understand what free trade is really about, not just exchange of goods and services and reduction of the tariffs, right? We need to understand what is the origins and relationship of free trade and free trade agreements to the development of what's called neoliberalism in the 70s and 80s in this country, which is the dominant economic strategy and social strategy of the ruling elite in this country. And we need to understand, why was it in the 1980s that they, the ruling elite, shifted to free trade? It wasn't always the case. Free trade treaties, right? Directly negotiating free trade. Okay. All right. Free trade, once again, you know, it's not about workers. It's not about small, medium businesses. And it's not about benefits for the taxpayer. All pay a price. All three of those groups pay for free trade. Ultimately, free trade is about transferring income from those groups, workers, small, medium business, and taxpayers, to multinational corporations. That's what it's about. That's what the ultimate result is. Money flows are an extremely important part of all these agreements, and that's embedded in a number of the provisions. You know, the TPP is 30 chapters. We'll talk about some of those chapters. But a number of those chapters are really focusing on not just the flow of goods between countries, but the flow of money and investment between countries. It's money flows, or what we call foreign direct investment. Money flowing out of the U.S. into these other countries on behalf of bankers and investors and corporations to expand production in these other countries. Of course, expanding production and investing in other countries means they're not investing in the U.S., and that means less jobs, particularly higher-paying, better-paying manufacturing jobs in the U.S., and that contributes to lower wages in the U.S. And it means multinational corporations being able to set up business instead of the U.S. in these other countries. That allows them to reduce their costs significantly. Their labor costs, their costs of production are much lower. Right? Other overhead costs, tax costs, transport costs, other costs of doing business are much lower. Multinational companies get preferred access by relocating to these countries to those foreign markets. You know, it's not just lower cost of production, it's access to the markets. The markets get open to them in those countries, and they use those countries as a base of exporting to the rest of the world. Instead of exporting from the U.S., they export from those countries to the rest of the world, as well as sell those products in those world, in those countries. And, of course, free trade means they get to re-import back to the U.S. They make the stuff offshore instead of here, and they re-import it back to the U.S. with lower tariffs. So they're making money on a whole number of range of developments here, making more money, multinationals. And, of course, the banks and finance companies benefit greatly because they often finance this offshore FDI expansion. They provide the loans. They provide the whole number of investment services to these companies as they move offshore. So it's the finance side, the bankers, that make a lot of, out of this, as well as the non-bank companies. Now, companies like General Electric and Boeing and so forth, right? And by the way, Boeing, let me digress and say something about Boeing. Boeing loves this agreement because Boeing now will be able to set up shop in Asia. You know, we had a show here several months ago about the settlement, about a year ago, the settlement Boeing workers in their union with the company. And one of the big issues in that company was workers taking pension cuts and other wage cuts in order to prevent the company, Boeing, from relocating to expanding its facilities in South Carolina and losing union jobs. So the unions, the workers in the union gave up a lot to prevent moving to Charleston, South Carolina. Well, nothing in the agreement said that they couldn't move to Malaysia. And now TPP is going to facilitate that. And Boeing is going to step up production in Asia. And that means more investment there rather than in Washington, Seattle. And that means ultimately a loss of jobs. Over time, the jobs will shift to Asia. Okay. So that's how short-sightedness of union negotiators end up screwing their own workers. Okay. We can talk about that topic in a whole number of examples here in the U.S., but The point is that lowering tariffs, which are taxes on the flow of goods, is only part of what free trade is. It's really about ensuring money flows and foreign direct investment of U.S. multinationals and bankers to set up shop in these other countries. Right? It's about production of goods in those countries, not just the flow of goods between those countries. Important element that is often overlooked. And then, of course, the banks participate. They grease the wheels of capital investment. And we see a lot of, in recent years here, all this talk about globalization, financialization, but that obscures the real wealth-making purposes and origins of free trade agreements. You know, this New York Times ideologist Friedman, he likes to talk about the earth is flat and so on and so forth, and mainstream economists go through logical contortions here to falsify the reality to justify free trade. You know, they all believe trade, free trade is good. Everybody benefits from free trade, so therefore let's have more of it. And their whole task is to create popular explanations like Friedman or more esoteric mathematical, logical explanations by academic economists for whom free trade is one of the holy grails of mainstream economics. It's always better for everybody. Everybody benefits. All boats rise in free trade, right, is the argument. No, not true. Workers lose their jobs. They get lower wages. There's less wage income. Households' consumption does not grow. GDP does not grow. Part of the problem with this subpar GDP growth that we're experiencing is, you know, a lot of real investment, expansion, real job producing high income wages investment has flown offshore. You know, we had this thing where we pumped trillions of dollars after the 2008-09 crash, central bank, into the economy, and it flowed right offshore. It flowed into financial asset markets, which didn't result in any real job creation, and or it flowed to emerging markets in China. You know, the money went right out, big leakage. You know, the bucket, the economic bucket, had a big hole in it. And not that money went, and you can't tell me that U.S. workers benefited by this money outflow. No way. Also, taxpayers don't benefit. Why? Because if you don't have investment and job creation, you don't have people paying taxes in the U.S., and therefore less taxes means bigger budget deficits, and the taxpayer has to make up the difference in social program cuts or other forms of taxes. And small, medium businesses, as I described, also do not benefit from this. Right? There's a reality of free trade as well as an ideological justification of it, you know, and if you read Friedman and academic economists, you're going to get a lot of ideology. You're not going to get a lot of facts. It is a fact that, for example, in 2000, we had almost 19 million workers in manufacturing in this country. The accelerating of free trade ever since then, in part, is significantly responsible for the reduction of that 19 million to about 11, 12 million in manufacturing. Yes, we've lost 6 to 7 million jobs in manufacturing. Just that one industry. A lot of that is due to free trade. Not all of it. Some of it's due to just incentives for businesses to get rid of workers and institute new plant and equipment technologies and so forth. That's about half of it, too. But we lost millions and millions, and those are high-paid jobs, manufacturing jobs, that we could really use right now to stimulate wage growth. You know, they talk about, oh, we got to do something about wages. Let's raise the minimum wage. Well, that's good, but you're talking about only part of the total workforce in the U.S., raising minimum wages. How about all those that have lost wages who still have jobs, and those who have totally lost their wages, lost their manufacturing jobs? Right, in the U.S. Not much talk about that, is there? Well, that's a bigger factor. If you want to restore wages and income, you better do something about stopping free trade. All right, but that's a train that's, of course, left the station. Number one priority as I said, over the past year, following the midterm elections last year, that and corporate tax cuts coming next. But they're really focusing on the free trade here. Okay, we've got to understand historical context of this. You just can't look at free trade and the free trade agreement and understand what's going on and where it's going. You must look at the history and the purpose and origins of this to really understand what is going on with all this push for free trade. Okay, let's do a little historical background here to try to understand this free trade agreement before we try to pick it apart. All right, a short history of free trade, right? It really originates in the 1980s under Reagan. But its true origins are really before that. Why did the capitalist class in this country shift so strongly and dramatically towards free trade agreements in the 1980s? And we'll document that as well. But it's important to understand why they made that shift then. Because we weren't always promoters of this kind of open-ended free trade in the U.S. But to really understand what's going on, you have to go back to the end of World War II and the formation of what was called in 1944 the Bretton Woods Agreement. Okay, what was Bretton Woods? Well, Bretton Woods was the U.S. establishing its global economic hegemony in various institutions and practices. Now, coming out of World War II, the U.S. was the only really extant economic powerhouse in the world. And the U.S. Had established, restructured the global international system in its image and to its benefit in 1944 with Bretton Woods. You know, there wasn't much trade during World War II, obviously. And even during the Great Depression, trade had collapsed. Pretty much from, well, actually the late 20s on. So there was the need to reestablish a whole new international monetary and trading system. And three institutions were envisioned at Bretton Woods. And that was the U.S. dollar would now be worth more than gold. Yeah, the U.S. dollar would be the international currency. It would not be really sharing that role with any other European currencies. They were given a minor role. The dollar was pegged to $35 per ounce of gold. Okay, and that became the quasi gold standard, you might say, U.S. dollar gold standard. Right, and as part of that, the U.S. established the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank at the same time in 1944. All right, what was the purpose of the Monetary Fund? The Monetary Fund was to bail out other countries' currencies in other countries in other parts of the world, emerging markets, which weren't emerging much then, and you know, primarily Europe. If their economies were short of funds in order to buy U.S. goods to restart their economy, right, they could borrow from the IMF, or if they had an imbalance in their trade, which of course they did with the U.S., everyone wanted to buy U.S. goods and no one had anything to sell to the U.S., so there was a massive trade deficit everywhere to the benefit of the U.S. The U.S. had a huge trade surplus, exports over imports, and everywhere else in the world had a huge trade deficit, right? Importing more from the U.S., not selling much back to the U.S. Well, that would mean those countries would run short of currency. So the IMF was really about bailing out the financial systems of these countries when they got into trouble and didn't have enough currencies. That was necessary, right? And that's the role of the IMF, to bail out sovereign governments and to prevent them from lowering the value of their currencies as a way to try to improve their exports. In other words, to prevent them from devaluing. That was a big problem in the 1930s. A lot of devaluation going on, and it exacerbated the Great Depression. So coming out of the World War II, the idea was let's stop these countries, everybody, from competing by devaluations. And, you know, to do that, when they're running a deficit, the IMF will loan them money and bail them out so they don't have to devalue. Right? That was necessary. But this gave the U.S., which dominated the IMF with votes and money, control over the governments of these other countries. That was an important element of U.S. global economic and political hegemony set up in the post-World War system, the IMF, and the dollar as the reserve and trading currency, you see. Those two things go hand in hand, and they are essential for U.S. economic imperialism. Now, you know, as a digression here, to the extent that other countries' currencies become trading currencies more and more important, like the Chinese are trying to establish, and or Chinese and European and other countries' influences within the IMF grow, or they set up another competing IMF, that undermines U.S. economic power and hegemony and reduces the U.S. money control over governments elsewhere in the world. The second institution created was called the World Bank. Now, the World Bank was all about providing development funds, project funds, to help the Europeans, you know, reestablish their infrastructure, rebuild their infrastructure. The World Bank, of course, would make loans, kind of like an infrastructure investment corporation, to these countries. And again, it was dominated by the U.S. and funded largely by the U.S. And a lot of the World Bank projects funding to, you know, reestablish construction and infrastructure was really money that was provided ultimately to U.S. companies who did a lot of the restructuring and reconstruction. And there was some of it let the Europeans share in that as well initially and more over time. But it was really about, you know, U.S. Corporations getting funded by the World Bank to do infrastructure construction in these countries. Again, World Bank, money control by the U.S. over these governments. They want these projects, get their economies devastated by the war, back on their feet. And to get them back on their feet, you know, they needed the money, so the U.S. controlled them. And the U.S. Used that money control as a way of establishing, you know, its political and military edifice in post-war period here. Right. Now, there was a third institution called the International Trade Organization that was supposed to be set up as part of Bretton Woods, but the U.S. Vetoed that. Why should the U.S., it was argued, give these other countries a voice in regulating the flow of goods and services between all the countries? The U.S. was the gorilla on the trade bloc. You know, they didn't need anybody to help them. Why give someone a voice? And the U.S. nixed it, right? The ITO, International Trade Organization, would not have allowed the U.S. To dominate these other countries with money like the World Bank and IMF did. You know, so it didn't have that advantage. In fact, it would open up the views of others and dilute U.S. Economic and political influence. So the U.S. nixed it, right? In the post-war, immediate post-war period, 1945 to about the middle of the 1960s, the U.S. dominated world trade. The U.S. ran trade surpluses. In other words, sold far more exports than it imported of goods from the rest of the world. We had a trade surplus, as it's called, right? And at the same time, apart from this surplus in goods exchanges, there was massive U.S. foreign direct investment outflow from the U.S. into these countries, particularly Europe and Japan. And the U.S. corporations and businesses, you know, solidified their takeover of many industries and companies within these countries, particularly Europe and Japan. Especially Japan. Japan became just an economic satrapy of the U.S., and still is in many ways. So massive, constant U.S. foreign direct investment out during this post-war period, and trade surplus, goods, money from goods flows in, while the money from FDI flowed out. These two things make up what's called the balance of payments. And if they get out of imbalance, in other words, if more money is flowing out than flowing in, we have a balance of payments problem, and that undermines the value of the U.S. dollar. And if the U.S. dollar declines, then, you know, the value of all these investments by these multinational corporations offshore declines. And if it, the dollar declines, they can't buy up as many companies and penetrate at the same rate they did. So it's important, you know, to keep the dollar up for foreign direct investment purposes. Okay. And from 1965 on, or 1960s on, the advantage the U.S. had began to disappear. In other words, our surplus of exports over imports began to disappear as Europe and other countries and regions began to develop further on their own. We weren't generating as much a trade surplus as we were before. In fact, we're approaching a trade deficit by 1970. At the same time, we had still this massive outflow of foreign direct investment by U.S. corporations. And over this whole period, 40s, 50s, 60s, of course, we had even further outflow of U.S. dollars as the U.S. expanded its military and political empire and solidified that empire, foreign aid and so forth, military bases, etc. So a lot of money flowing out increasingly and not as much flowing in, which meant the U.S. Was beginning to have a balance of payments problem, which meant that the U.S. dollar was under pressure, which meant that they couldn't keep it maintained at $35 an ounce to gold. That brings us to the early 1970s. This is going to be related to TPP. Hold on, we're getting there. In 1970s, Nixon, Richard Nixon, introduced what was called the New Economic Policy, at the heart of which was trying to restructure this problem to the advantage of U.S. multinationals. And, you know, the core development element in his NEP policy was to devalue the dollar, to take the dollar off of this Bretton Woods $35 an ounce gold standard. By letting the dollar devalue, it made the U.S. more competitive vis-a-vis its partners, increased exports over imports some, you know, which reversed this trend where imports were beginning to take precedence over exports, because they want to continue the foreign direct investment flows all the time. They don't want to mess with those, you know. But you needed a positive trade surplus in order to ensure that the foreign direct investment outflows were not out of balance. Okay, so the NEP was all about devaluing the U.S. currency and the end of the Bretton Woods Agreement, right? And the end of that Bretton Woods Agreement, by the way, contributed to the crisis of the global economy and U.S. economy in the 1970s. And, of course, that meant there was very a decline in U.S. investment, domestic investment in the U.S., and a chronic slowing of economic growth in the U.S. And by the late 1970s, business elements in the U.S. said we need a new restructuring here. Right? And that new restructuring was going to be Reaganism, i.e. neoliberalism. Originates in the late 70s. In the U.S. and U.K., over there they call it Thatcherism. So neoliberalism is a product of the crisis of the 1970s and the attempt by the capitalist class to reestablish a new structure in global international relationships, as well as to restructure the domestic economies where more would be extracted from workers and consumers and taxpayers, and more income and wealth would flow to corporations and wealthy investors. So there's the domestic element to neoliberalism and an international element. And it's the international element that we need to understand of neoliberalism, because that leads directly through to free trade. And what we're seeing now, the deepening and expanding of free trade, it's part of neoliberalism. You know, when you talk about neoliberalism, they tend to think about correctly domestic neoliberalism. And what was that? Oh, that means that we got to shift taxes from wealthy investors and corporations to individuals in the middle class, right? That's one element of domestic neoliberalism. Another element, let's cut social programs. Because we're cutting taxes, we're going to increase our deficit. So let's cut social program spending in order to help offset the reduction government tax revenue and therefore deficits and budget imbalances, especially since we're going to raise defense spending. You say we're going to cut social programs, we're going to raise defense spending, and that's going to have a problem with creating a budget deficit, particularly if you raise defense spending much more than you cut social programs, which is what happens. Right? And at the same time, you're cutting taxes on the rich. Well, that happens, and that further raises the budget deficit. More defense spending, not offset by social program spending, plus tax cuts for the rich and corporations means your budget deficit goes up. Well, Reaganism was also about, well, let's privatize these industries, and that will lead to more business investment and more tax revenue. You know, let's deregulate and encourage more business development, business investment as a result, to offset this budget deficit problem that we're going to create. Let's deunionize the workforce in order to lower business costs and encourage business development and investment. That's all part of domestic neoliberalism, and all about we're going to cut taxes and spend more on corporations and so forth, and that's going to create a budget deficit, but we're going to offset that. We're cutting social programs and cutting business costs to stimulate the supply-side investment, as they call it, except it didn't work. What happened was we ended up with chronic and rising budget deficits under Reagan. And the problem was also internationally, there was a big problem with neoliberalism, Reaganism, and that was the U.S. Had not solved its problem of trade deficits, growing trade deficits. You know, two of the major legacies of Reagan was this chronic and rising budget deficits every year and trade deficits every year. And, yeah, I don't know why people think Reagan was so great. You know, he messed up the economy long term, big time. Didn't work. Budget deficits accelerated, and deregulation, designed to lower business costs and stimulate investment, deregulation on the financial side led to bubbles and crashes. You know, 1982-3, we had a housing crash. 86, we had a 7, we had a stock market crash. Then we had a junk bond crash. Then we had another real estate crash. All of this during the 80s under Reagan. So domestic realism, neoliberalism, excuse me, was a pretty much a failure in some ways. It did transfer income to the rich, but it didn't really solve some of the other problems. This is where free trade comes in. Free trade becomes a kind of, and the international side restructuring of neoliberalism plays a key role. And it's often overlooked. You know, when people talk about neoliberalism, they mostly focus on domestic policies, but they miss the far more important, or just as important, international element of neoliberalism created by the U.S. In the 1980s under Reagan, just begun under Reagan, which depends on free trade, right? International neoliberalism is free trade. They're one and the same. At the heart of this international neoliberalism and free trade is what's called the twin deficits. It's a neoliberal solution to the missing links and problems of Reaganism. Call it neoliberalism phase two. How do you solve these domestic missing links and problems and domestic neoliberalism with rising budget deficits and failure supply side and so forth, right? All right, so what's the twin deficits and why are they essential and part of free trade? Okay, twin deficits. In the 1980s, the U.S. decided, the ruling elite in the U.S. decided, they were going to shift from trying to establish a trade surplus, in other words, from trying to maximize exports over imports, and let a trade deficit occur. In other words, allow these other countries in the world to run a trade surplus with us, and we'd run a trade deficit. In other words, allow more imports into the U.S. than exports from the U.S. Well, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't solve the problems they were developed since the 50s and 60s. Well, yes, it does, so long as part of this agreement with these other countries in the world, and capitalists elsewhere, is that the money would be recycled back to the U.S. In other words, when we have a trade deficit, more money flows out of the U.S., more dollars flow out of the U.S., and they flow into the banks and central banks of these other countries. But if those central banks and other countries recycle the money back to the U.S. by buying U.S. Treasury bonds, the U.S. can run a budget deficit. The twin deficit, the trade deficit part, money outflows greater than inflows, but recycling of those accumulated dollars overseas allows the U.S. to run a huge budget deficit. That means the U.S. can continue to cut taxes on the rich, can spend more money on wars and defenses, because the money for that will be coming back from the trade deficit. Now, capitalists in other countries love this arrangement, you know, because that means that the U.S. Will allow them to increase their sales to the U.S. And, quote, allowing them really means allowing a lot of U.S. multinational corporations that relocated offshore that are sending these goods back as well. So there's a big cut of the pie that U.S. imperialism allows these other national elites in these other countries to participate in. It's all a part of solidifying the U.S. economic empire. You see, let the indigenous capitalists have a taste, have a piece of the action. Tie them into you that way. You know, let them make money by selling commodities and semi-finished goods and agricultural goods and so forth back to the U.S. You know, let them make some money out of this, too. And the money flowing back to the U.S., as long as they buy the treasury bonds, that's fine. You know, because then the government has sufficient financing to allow it to cut taxes for the rich and corporations in the U.S. and decrease war spending. And, you know, once in a while we'll have a domestic program, you know, like Part D of the Medicare system, where you provide prescription drugs for seniors. You know, you allow them to get some benefit there, but most of it, it's a big boondoggle for pharmaceutical companies, since they get to raise prices as much as they want, and you can't negotiate with them, et cetera. You know, so it's really a flow-through of wealth to pharmaceutical company investors, corporations. That's what Part D is. And by the way, ACA Obamacare is in that same tradition. Most of the benefit goes to these health insurance companies. Yeah, there are a few benefits. You know, we get to buy $4,000 deductible health insurance. Right? It's all you can afford under ACA anyway. So there's some, you know, trickle-down benefit there for consumers, just as some seniors get some benefit assistance on pharmaceutical drugs. But, you know, the lion's share goes to the health insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies. Okay, so twin deficits mean trade deficit, budget deficit. The trade deficit funds the budget deficit. The budget deficit funding allows the U.S. to cut taxes for the rich and increase war spending. Right? It works so long as the money flows back. And it's not just China, hundreds of billions a year flowing back, but it's Japan, it's Europe, it's the petrodollar Saudi economies. Everywhere in the world, we run a trade deficit, and everywhere in the world, they funnel the money back. And they don't have to buy just bonds, treasury bonds. You know, we allow them to invest in buying other assets, financial and other, in the United States. We let the Europeans buy more of that, and the Japanese. And we're a little careful about, you know, other countries, what they buy apart from treasury bonds. But you know, we open it up a little bit, as long as they recycle the money back. Right, that's all that really matters. Twin deficits are the core of this. Free trade is about increasing the trade deficit in order to get more money flowing back to fund the larger budget deficit, you see. Free trade's at the core now. It's the new way to keep the trade deficit going, so long as we can ensure the money be recycled back to the U.S. Free trade is necessary. The growth and expansion of free trade is necessary to keep this twin deficit international neoliberal solution going. That's why the U.S. needs more and more free trade. Okay. Free trade begins under Reagan with the passage of the first free trade agreement with Canada in 1988. Before that, there really was a pilot project of free trade, and that was under LBJ, Johnson. It was called the Maquiladora pilot project. That was a three-mile range on the border, Mexican-U.S. border, allowing U.S. companies to relocate just across the border and take advantage of the low-cost labor and then send those goods back across the border to the U.S. without tariffs and taxes. That was the pilot project, you see. So the Democrats have always been on board with this from the beginning. They talk about, some of them talk about free trade, but that's just lip service. When it comes down to a vote, they vote for it, right? Democrats voted for it, allowed it to pass. When they expanded free trade to Mexico under NAFTA in 1993, couldn't have passed it without Democrat votes. They were involved, Democrat votes, in Congress, allowing China to have preferred nation trading rights, which is, free trade light. In 2000, we've lost at least 3 million jobs to China since then, high-paying jobs, right? And, of course, Obama's the biggest free trader of all. So we see this acceleration and expansion of free trade. In the 1990s, it was Mexico added to NAFTA, right? And then the World Trade Organization, which was passed in the 90s, under Clinton, the Democrat, both. Republican could never have passed NAFTA, Mexico NAFTA. Only a Democrat could get it through Congress. And that's what happened in the 1990s. And we've lost millions of jobs and uncountable reduction of wages for those who still had jobs, right? And then Bush comes on, George W., and passes the Central America Free Trade Agreement in 2005 and tries to pass a expansion of that throughout South America called the Free Trade of the Americas. But that was blocked by a number of South American countries in the 2000s as the U.S. was internally focused more on 9/11 and the Middle East, gave a little breathing space for these countries in South America to become a little bit more independent. But Bush then embarked upon what a number of bilateral free trade agreements with separate countries, Israel, Chile, and Australia, and so forth. And then, of course, we get Obama comes into office. 2008, Obama promises to renegotiate the NAFTA agreement, says he's against free trade. Another lie. He totally turned around as soon as he got in office on that one. And in 2010, he appointed Jeff Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, to lead his free trade initiatives. Right. At the same time, he wrapped up some of these loose ends from the Bush period, free trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. In 2010, MO and big manufacturing MNCs and so forth in the U.S. Developed this proposal for TPP, expanding TPP. And they waited until the 2012 election. And, then they started pushing this thing in Obama's second term, right? And they really started pushing this thing after last November midterm elections. And, of course, it's not surprising that Obama got fast-track authority. What fast-track means Congress can't even debate this TPP thing that's just been agreed to. They have to just vote it up or down, which means it's, the wheels are greased here. This thing's going through, folks. That doesn't mean you shouldn't fight it, because there's an awful lot of other agreements coming right behind it. But this is number one priority, multinational corporations here. And they're getting their way very clearly. already with this Congress, including Democrats. You know, there's a few progressive Democrats who are fighting it, but, you know, this progressive wing of the Democratic Party is shrinking. You know, they're increasingly a voice in the wilderness here. And, you know, the politicians running for office, Hillary and others, you know, they'll say what they think they have to say to convince people, like Obama did when he ran, that, you know, he's going to do something about the loss of jobs and wages and all the other problems, the environmental problems and so forth, that free trade, which is really big corporations running amok, produce. They'll say what you think, what they think you want to hear, and American people naively will believe them, majority at least. And then they'll go around and they'll do what they want anyway. And that's the reality. That's how the game, the electoral game, is played here in the U.S. So their protestations against TPP, notwithstanding, you know, especially Hillary. Hillary will not allow herself to be outflanked by anybody on this issue. She will move left carefully, modestly, make it appear as if there's a problem with TPP and she's willing to look at it, you know, because Obama outflanked her back in 2008. Obama very clearly tagged her with Bill Clinton's NAFTA, and she really didn't have a good answer to it. And Obama came out and appeared as if he was against free trade, all right? By the way, back there in 2008, when Obama did this, it created a little bit of a furor here with the Canadians, you know. And the Canadians said, well, what's wrong with this guy? He's against free trade and so on and so forth. Well, quietly, Obama had one of his operatives tell the Canadians, oh, look, we're just talking about this. This isn't real. And that leaked out, created a little bit of a stir for a short while in 2008. Oh, but the press, you know, quickly... did not run with that one because Obama was the guy they wanted, the capitalists wanted, you know. They needed a change. They needed somebody that the people would believe in that would be a change, even though there wasn't going to be a change. So Hillary will not allow herself to be outflanked. She will say what she thinks she needs to say. Of course, Sanders is more strongly opposed to it, but Sanders knows he's not going to get any nomination. He's already said that if he doesn't, he's not going to run independently. So he can afford to say whatever he wants. All right, so that brings us up to the big push now, the acceleration of free trade under the TPP and all the 50 other agreements coming behind it. Now, in previous shows, we've warned about some of the elements of this. You know, we warned about this pharmaceutical deal, which would give U.S. companies a global patent protection, just as in the U.S. You know, they get to raise whatever prices they want for 10 years on these new biologic life-saving drugs. It's 12 years. 12 years, right? That's why we got this runaway price escalation in pharmaceutical drug prices. And it's not just for life-saving biologics. You know, we've talked about that, Turing Pharmaceuticals and Valiant and all these other countries that are gouging everybody now because Wall Street and hedge funds got their claws into these pharmaceutical companies, taking them over. And they got this new strategy where they're jacking up the prices, right? And because we have laws that, you know, that say you can't negotiate these prices with these people. They're, you know, charging whatever the hell they want. And it's not just biologics now. It's spilling over right now to other drugs as well. You know, those of you who are on Medicare Part D or have prescription drugs in your employer coverage in your employer health insurance plans, you know, you're seeing those costs, monthly costs, escalate dramatically. And that's because of all this price gouging going on in pharmaceuticals. And that's because they have this 12-year guarantee of patent monopoly. And now in TPP, they're going to have it globally. Well, they say, well, it's only 5 years. No, there's another 3-year extension. And in special situations, it's up to 11 years. That's in the pharma deal, in the TPP, right? Obama's statement on TPP, and you know, if you read it on his website, says it's going to be a level playing field, quote, yeah, for whom? For corporations? globally, certainly not workers, right? And he says, U.S. U.S. workers are at a disadvantage because we can't export cars to Vietnam because of their tariffs. Well, how the hell many cars are you going to sell to Vietnam from the U.S.? I mean, give me a break. What an example, right? U.S. workers will now be able to compete with lower wages offshore because tariffs will be reduced. Well, wait a minute. Look at the agreement. Tariffs reduced over a 15, 20-year period, and we're talking about pretty minimal tariffs. At the same time, in this agreement, there is nothing to prevent these countries from driving down their currencies, the exchange rate, which has a much greater impact on competitive prices of their goods than tariffs. You know, all this stuff talk about tariffs is irrelevant because they're so minimal and they're so long period to implement here, they can reduce their exchange rates overnight. You know, and they have. In these other 12 countries offshore, you know, all of their currencies are declining rapidly against the dollar. Now we're going to raise interest rates and dollar's going to go up even more. So they're getting a 10, 20, 30% advantage in their prices of their products against the U.S. And all this talk about tariffs, you know, it's just a diversion. It won't do anything. But it confuses people, right? It makes you think, oh, TPP is going to reduce tariffs, therefore we get more exports from the U.S., therefore more jobs, you know. The reality is quite the contrary. Okay. And Obama touts the TPP standards, but we've got new standards for labor, for environment, right? And an open internet. Yeah, they want an open internet so the NSA can surveil everybody around the world easier, right? Free flow of data and information. Yeah, that's for U.S. Communications companies and software companies, right? So they don't have to set up shop in these foreign countries, which are the rules now, to sell their data and their software. They can do it from the U.S., right? More U.S. access to these countries, U.S. corporate access and U.S. government access, right? And then he says the U.S. needs to write the rules. If it doesn't, China will. Yeah, but rules for whom? Whose benefit? Whose rules? You know, benefit workers and the environment? No. Or China will? Oh, yeah. That's one of the main goals of TPP, to contain China, right? Obama says it's a new type of trade deal. No, it isn't. It's old wine in new bottles. And it puts American workers first. Well, that's a double no. Nonsense. Just read the statements coming from the United Steelworkers and some other unions here, whether this is going to benefit their workers. They know. Okay, officially, the TPP document has 30 chapters in it, but you've got to look at what's called the annexes and the schedules, the exceptions and applications of some of this to really understand what's going on. Now, we can't cover all of these 30 sections, and actually we're probably running out of time here to go into a deep inspection of the different sections, and we'll probably have to continue this analysis next week, and it'll allow us a little bit more time to see what the reactions are as well from labor and environmental groups and so forth. But let me say a few things about this, right? First of all, the section on goods trade, right, talks about reducing tariffs over, quote, longer time frames. Yeah, I just mentioned that, didn't I? It allows licensing regulations in these countries to continue. So I can reduce my tariff, maybe. No, forget about reducing my currency. But then I'll just, continue with licensing and non-tariff barriers here, and the same thing will happen, you know. Agricultural food security increases are a provision here. Come on, you know, this section is really about allowing U.S. agricultural GMOs, generic modified food, exports into these countries. That's what it's really about, right? These countries have laws that block the exports of GMOs, some of them, Well, they can't do that anymore. And that raises another important element here, and that is what free trade agreement TPP really means is that if it's a treaty, you can't pass domestic legislation to contradict the treaty. So you're giving up some of your domestic sovereignty. And boy, we're going to be doing that big time here if we ratify this treaty. You know, big time. In other words, the loss of sovereignty and democracy. Another element of this is the dispute settlement section, which means this is going to disputes and resolution of issues are going to be settled in a special courts. You know, forget the U.S. domestic courts, you know, over which we have some influence, appointments, and elections, you know, of judges. No, this is total corporate courts. In fact, they call them panels, right? Panels. These panels, whenever there's an issue, will be constituted within 30, 90 days. But they don't say anything about the composition of the panels. Who are these judges? Who are these people going to sit on these panels? Where are they going to come from? Well, they're going to be corporate people. That's who. Well, they're the ones who are going to make the decisions. And, you know, labor's not going to be there, and environmental groups aren't going to be there, and, you know, others aren't going to be there sitting in these panels in these courts. Going to be simply corporate-to-corporate decision-making. That's going to be binding on everybody. And forget about passing any other contrary legislation if you don't like the decision. And the initial reports of these courts will be confidential. You won't even know what they decided. Well, they'll publish something, but then you get the comment after the fact, after it's a done deal. Okay? That's a little bit about goods trade. Now, investment trade, FDI, foreign direct investment, ooh, very tight language, beneficial to U.S., quote, TPP parties, their markets will be fully open to foreign investors, just what the U.S. really wants. And frivolous class action suits, you know, will be discouraged, you know, with time limits and so forth. In other words, it's really about investment, folks, not just goods trade. And service markets will be fully open as well. Free transfer of funds. Oh, that's what the banks want. Move this money around. And you'll be able to sell from abroad via the Internet. You won't have to set up operations in these countries if you're a banker or a service company. Special annexes on insurance corporations, credit card corporations, data processing corporations. All of these will have special benefits. State-owned enterprises can't compete with the U.S., right? Patents, trademarks. We talked about Big Pharma and their 11-year guarantee, right? E-commerce, free flow of global information, e-commerce section here, right? No required data centers setting up in these countries to sell data. It's going to be from the U.S., right? No taxes on e-commerce, etc. Okay, so we'll talk some more about this next week. We haven't really gotten into the details the way I had hoped that we would. So we're going to continue taking apart this TPP, and we'll do a little review of what some of the reactions are by labor, environmental groups, and others. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.